Hello, this is Kyle Jones. Today we continue our study concerning time is light. The Hebrew root, ur, which is both substantive and verb, finds its linguistic relation to the Ugaritic or Old Babylonian ur, which means to be bright, to illuminate. And prior to the Babylonian ur, we find an older cognate within the Akkadian uru, which means day. The Shuresh, or Hebrew root word, nur, comes from its word, ur, from which the word menorah, or lampstand, comes from. And again, the Ugaritic, or Old Babylonian, has its affiliate and paternally older, nair, which means lamp, light, to illumine. While still, the older Akkadian, nuru, means light. Returning to a concurrent language of Hebrew, we find the verb nahar, which means to shine, and its substantive nahara, which means daylight. We also find this in the Aramaic word, in use in the Old Testament, such as naga, which means to shine. Other close words to our Hebrew word ur will be found in the Old Testament as the naga, which means brightness, and yafa, in its hifil form, meaning to shine forth, to shine out, and finally, shakar as dawn, or ben shakar as sons of dawn. In Babylonian religion and their Ugaritic text, the idea of light and dark were not considered to be relevant within their belief systems. Rather, fertility religion was the focal point, and for that reason, it was the changes in the seasons that were to be focused on. To understand the idea of light, we must go further back into Sumeria, where our understanding of light can be illuminated. The main Sumerian masculine gods were the gods of, number one, atmosphere, number two, heaven, and the third god, the underground ocean god. Also, the main goddess of the Sumerians was the goddess of the earth. As a side note, I would like to say that it is my dearest friend, Dr. David Lawrence, who made very clear to me that it was the Sumerians who gave us writing, agriculture, and the stars to understand. Prior to the Sumerians, we had nothing of the sort. It would be, therefore, in reason to establish the idea that something supernatural or preternatural did occur within the Sumerian culture. To the Sumerians, it was the atmospheric god out of the gods who moved upon creation and reformed the creation by separating heaven and earth. He acted within the springtime as one would or can associate springtime as a Sumerian. This same atmospheric god was called the bright-eyed god and is identified as the god who, quote, makes his emblems bright. He, the bright-eyed god, that is, the atmospheric god, had preeminence over the sun god and the moon god. His light to the Sumerians represented wisdom. This same Sumerian god of the atmosphere, who was seen as divider of heaven and earth, was seen in his Babylonian attributes as one of the fertility or agricultural deities. The Babylonians were not in contrast to the Sumerians in their beliefs. Rather, they were syncretists to the Sumerian gods in that they associated the heavenlies to that which is earthly. Therefore, syncretism of God and his movements upon the earth were necessarily to be understood by the agricultural society of Babylon as heavenly movements. The idea of light as spring, that is, the Sumerian god of springing forth of the sun, was understood by the Babylonians to be the god of the springtime equinox. Such a light, that is, the stylization of light, to the Hebrews would be that called oth, or the sign. In this case, the sign of the time of the spring. The interesting thing for me is that the atmospheric god was seen by the Sumerians as Mu-Lu-Hung-Ga in constellar association. This same constellation was so well understood by the Old World that the Babylonians had to add nothing to its meaning. They only recorded and followed it as part of the path of living for the instruction of the heaven and the earth. Before I begin to translate the meaning of this beautiful springtime equinox god, I would just like to reiterate from our last lecture that it was the stars who were considered to be the prophets, or Nebi, who told of a great king to come and what he would do. Not only tell, but to narrate the story for all of the world as to the manner or fashion that this god-king would act upon. That is, how would he enter our world from the heavens? One last thing I have already addressed in my lecture called Pictographic Societies, that it was the sum or aggregate understanding within the pictograph or pictograph of the older Chinese, Egyptians, and Sumerians that took in the total meaning of the reader. When there are strings of words that I mention in this lecture concerning Sumerian or other pictographic words, one word is inseparable from the other in its meaning and content. As a startup for a good reference tool, one should look into Dr. Halloran's Sumerian Lexicon, also Marie-Louise Thompson's The Sumerian Language, and Samuel Noah Kramer's The Sumerians. In the word Mu-Lu-Hung-Ga, we have our Akkadians to thank for its retentive meaning. In total sum, it meant hired man, or the man who would do the job. The constituent words Mu-Lu-Hung-Ga, or the hired man, can be read as follows. Mul can be seen pictured as a group of three stars or trinity of gods in this aggregate word for the hired man. Lu is our next constituent word that means, quote, the free man, that is, the one who worked, did, husband, owner, as opposed to slave, truly free, quote unquote, much like our man of the domicile, head of the house. Hunga, the last of the constituent words within this aggregate, mu-lu-hunga, meant the professional or one who was hired, that is, the task taker and doer. Again, Mu-Lu-Hung-Ga meant the man who would do the job. But we are not through yet. For each constituent, Sumerian word has its cluster or group of constituents. Let's begin. Lu was a word that meant sheep. Hung-Ga meant, quote, to rest, to be still, to placate or appease, to lift away. The spring or bright light god, the god of the Sumerians, who separated the heavens from the earth, waters from land, who shows himself in splendor in association with the resurrecting god of life, and is directly identified by the Sumerian constellation Lu, which means the sheep of appeasement, who would do his job, bringing peace, bringing rest, making still, taking away. Furthermore, the regency from such a Sumerian sacrificial animal was to be called Damu, or rightful son, or heir. Damu in Sumerian means the son of inheritance, where we can find Dumuzi in the Epic of Bilgamesh, and earlier accounts of this in the later Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh. Such son of inheritance can be depicted in Sumerian icons as fishermen, gods of shepherding, or orchardmen. We get our constellation Aries from the Sumerian Lu. It is of special significance that Aries is now to be focused on, for Aries conveys the concept of portentous time, that is, time of resurrection, time of death, and time of rebirth, as light that resurrects. It is within the story of this light, this sheep of appeasement, that we will focus our attention. The ancient Egyptians already had their Maseroth, or narrated constellation, from the Sumerians. The Egyptian Maseroth was called the Dendera, which was a book of 12 main stories to the Egyptians, which we might refer to as the Decans. In Egypt, the Sumerian Lu, or Aries, was called Tammuturis Amon. Again, we have the Egyptians to thank for the retention of meaning held by the Sumerians on this. The Egyptians knew of this story, book, or house as the one who reigns, has dominion, or government of Amon, and is seen as a lamb or sheep in the heavens. This same lamb was also seen by the Egyptians as the resurrection aspect of the goat. And this goat had preceded the lamb by one procession of equinox. The Arabic name for the Sumerian Lu was and is called Al-Hamal, which means the sheep, the gentle, the merciful. Our Syriac gives us the name Amru, as we see in John chapter 1, verse 29. Quote, "Behold, the Amru, or Lamb of God, which takes away the sin of the world." The Akkadians, who were to be thanked, going back in time again, for retaining the Sumerian meaning of this lamb, the Akkadians called it Bara Zigar. Bara was Akkadian for altar or sacrifice, and Zigar meant right making. The composite meaning was called the sacrifice of righteousness. For a moment, I would like to say that the signs and symbols, or in Hebrew, the Auth, had specific semiotic meanings to these earlier cultures. The stylization of symbol was the lesser meaning of the social context from which we get truer meaning from, and then a return to the symbols again. That is, the signs and symbols of the stars had greater significance in language within the social context than what we understand today. The earlier cultures were day in and day out, more or less baptized in these significant lights, in a way that we cannot comprehend. Therefore, these signs in the heavens were a constant, if you will, a record player, repeating the same tale for these early pictographic cultures. As are the pictograms, so are the stars. For the word contains many ideas summed into one. As a pictographic word conveys many parts, so does a constellation. Well, let's begin to dissect Lu, or Aries, from its composite meanings. There are 66 stars in Aries. The main star is in the forehead. It was called El-Nath in the ancient Middle East. El-Nath meant wounded, that is, slain. Such a word was so well known that even Geoffrey Chaucer used this term to reference the main star of the springtime. We continue within the head region of Aries to find out our next star, called Meratim, which is retained in our Hebrew, meaning the bound or the bound one. Herodotus, a famed ancient Greek historian, records that the Egyptians would once a year follow the sun's movement until it fell into Aries. At this point, the sun was seen as a porthole or entrance into the heavens by way of the sun. At this marked time, the Egyptians would slay a ram, which is called the festival of Jupiter Ammon. And to be exact on this ram, it wasn't a ram. It was a specific type of Amru called a lamb, as we shall see. The festival continued by placing branches over the doors of the Egyptians. This ram of sacrifice, or Amru, lamb, was decked with a garland of wreaths and flowers carried off into the procession. The sun, at this time in the Egyptian festival, would begin to enter Aries, the constellation, on the 14th of what we would call Nisan to the Jews. The Egyptians, at this point of the procession, the first of the three main days of the festival, were where the Egyptians would order another sacrifice in the place of the ram, which was another type of Amon, which I have said, which we would call a lamb. It is this very procession in the heavens that was acted out on earth by the Egyptians that symbolized the spring equinox, or return of the sun to regenerate. This Egyptian archetypical lamb can easily be seen as that of the Christ, for it was during the Egyptian festival, which was also the time of Moses' account of Exodus, where we had the procession of the equinoxes. The sun had receded into the signs of Aries and had further receded directly into the ram. These processional equinoxes lined up directly in date to that of the death of the Christ, based on the time of the Jewish historical Passover and observances that were mentioned in the Bible concerning Jesus' time of death. Furthermore, as we shall see, the very day which I believe the incarnation of Christ occurred was the third day of the procession of the Egyptians, that is, the resurrection day, which was 3 days after the Egyptian sacrifice had occurred. Our date, April 17th, would have been the date that the old world would have seen as the day of the resurrection God. It is interesting that by the best treatments on the birth of Christ that I have read, we see that this is the very day that Christ was incarnated into this world. I never use the term born because I believe that the Christ has always been, by his very pre-incarnate title to Moses, Ehyeh, or, quote, I have always been. Next week, we will begin to cover this regally portentous time of Christ's incarnation, found in the well-backed study of numismatics, or study of coins used in the old world. We shall study what was on the coins in particular, where the scorings of Aries, Jupiter, and their regal and portent messiahs occurred. The significance of this messiah to come was so great to all of the ancient world that the very ancient governments in charge of stamping their own coins would, in due time, give such an image to this Christ that it was simply undeniable what had occurred on April 17th, some 2,000 millennia before us.